This week on Writers, Inc.
And typically within the first 20,000 words, I am going to discover whether this idea actually is hanging together and whether I think that there's a path forward.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories. All have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, I'm Christine Daigle.
I'm Jenna Brown.
I'm Kevin Tomlinson.
And I'm J.D. Barker. Welcome to Writers, Inc. So have you guys picked up your tickets for the Odyssey yet?
No.
That was like 2,000 years ago. What? How are we going to get tickets?
I love a Christopher Nolan movie, but I don't know if I'm going to pay $1,000 to see it at IMAX on opening night.
No.
Yeah.
It was filmed in IMAX? Was it like, it was filmed in IMAX, which I guess is why they're pushing the IMAX experience. But like, yeah, tickets are going on eBay for hundreds.
Well, and I think Christopher Nolan said, like, this is the ideal way to view the movie. So if you're like a Christopher Nolan diehard and he says, see it in IMAX, you're going to do whatever you can to see it in IMAX, I guess.
I don't know. I'm not that much of a snob.
I can't imagine paying that much to go see a movie. It makes me wonder, like, the conspiracy theorist in me, like, is this real or is he out there buying up all these tickets, creating some kind of false?
Yeah. So that's where I land. I think it's
how to make money.
I think that the studio.
Kevin, put your tinfoil hat on.
Yeah.
Explain.
Well, that's, I don't know. He's come out saying that this is purely a run for the, like, an award. Mm-hmm. You know, and he's really kind of, I don't want to get too political or anything, but I mean, he's doing things that just for the sole reason that he wants it to win an award. I just don't see why anybody would pay to go see this movie. I'm going to wait until it's out on streaming and free streaming at that.
I'm not like a cinephile, but like what is the difference in IMAX versus like watching it on like an HDD? TV.
I guess you feel like, surrounded.
Right. Here's like, what you do. Where you're sitting now is like a standard movie. Lean forward and look at your screen. And now you're in IMAX.
That is not true. That, isn't it like
that's all it,
like
it is.
It's like more
bigger
immersive.
Picture.
It's more immersive, right?
There's like a curved screen. And,
it's curved.
You know, yeah. But I have yet to see anything in IMAX that I didn't enjoy just as much on a regular screen.
Gets in your peripheral vision? I don't know.
Did you guys see Oppenheimer?
Yeah, I did.
Yes, but I didn't see it at the theater.
No, I haven't been to a theater in years.
He did something with the sound in there where it was like the sound was crazy loud, like versus the voices. Mm-hmm. Like I watched it in the theater and like I couldn't understand half the dialogue.
Yeah.
So and it could be because I'm getting older or whatever, but
I feel like that's every movie though.
No, it was cranked up. Like there were a lot of complaints about it online. Like he brought the soundtrack and everything up a lot higher than it normally is versus dialogue.
Yeah.
So like for me to watch it at home, like I can adjust the settings and I can make it all work. But like in the theater, I couldn't.
Right.
And, like it was frustrating as hell because like it seemed like a really good movie. It sounded like a pretty decent movie,
but I
couldn't follow it.
Particular about what I will see in the movie theater, and like I really wanted to see Project Hail Mary.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, that's gonna be worth it, but it was 2.5 hours. I'm like, hell no, I will not watch anything over 2 hours in the movie theater.
Wow.
No, I'm like, I'm gonna miss part of it because you know you have to get your soda and then you need a break. They need intermissions for movies. You want me to stay 2.5 hours? Come on now.
Granted, I don't have the same home theater system at the moment because we're traveling. But my home theater system way outperforms IMAX. So
I mean, I have a 60-inch screen, which is nowhere near JD's, but it's like big, so I can watch it on my 60-inch screen. I probably will watch it on my laptop, but I could watch it on my 60.
And you're comfortable. Like I don't know. I mean, I guess like if you want to see like all the nuance, but I agree with you, JD. Like it's nice to be at home where you can like adjust the sound and you can like you can control all everything that's going on.
You can hit pause.
You can hit pause. And there's no annoying strangers near you.
The big movie I watched last night was Mr. Holland's Opus, because I had never seen it.
That's a good movie.
It is a good
movie. I vaguely
movie.
Remember seeing that a very, very long time ago. Is that Richard Dreyfuss?
Yeah.
Okay.
It is
90s.
It was heartfelt. It had a hopeful message. Yeah, it's a 90s movie.
Very 90s. Yeah.
That's basically the kind of thing I'm watching now, because I'm just so over Hollywood.
I want to watch.
Not 90s. Now we're going to go 80s. But I don't know if you saw, they're showing Lost Boys. What's the city it was in California?
Santa Monica?
Santa Clara.
Santa Clara.
They're showing it outside.
And
all these people are coming to go see Lost Boys. So there's your 80s nostalgia for you in the city where it was filmed.
So that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I would probably do that.
Yeah.
I would.
All right. Let's talk about how we might be able to afford a $1,000 IMAX ticket.
Fine.
Authors Guild looks at why author incomes are in decline. A new study backed by the Authors Guild found that author incomes have fallen roughly 42% since 2009, with the average author now earning only about $10,000 a year from writing. The report says only 25% of print and ebooks read in the previous month were actually purchased new or through a paid subscription. Most books were obtained through libraries, used book purchases, borrowing from friends, or personal collections. The study argues that while books are reaching readers through more formats and channels than ever before, authors often earn less from those channels.
Well, this makes me very sad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
it's not good news.
I guess sharing, I know, I don't know how I feel about that argument, because yes, for that one initial book, but if you find an author that you love, you're going to want to keep reading them. And I don't know that you can always guarantee your friends are going to be able to lend it to you. And then when new books come out, you want to read them fast. So
yeah.
I
do you guys object to libraries? Some authors do.
I don't.
No.
I love them. I mean, check my books out at the library. I'm fine with that. I know I make a lot less money off of it, but I'd rather you read it
than
and
not
love
read it. Yeah.
I think that writing is always a marathon and not a sprint. And I think that, that's part of it, is that, someone might borrow your book or buy it at Goodwill, but if they end up loving it and loving you as an author, then it's done its job, and the fruits of your labor will come back to you in the end, I think.
Well, my first thoughts when I read this was I need to turn off all my library lending, is any place where I have control over it. But then I took a step back and kind of started thinking into that. And the bottom line is, it's almost like the book pirates. Everybody's going to get their book the way they get their book.
Yeah.
If they can't afford to buy it and they always get their books from the library, that's how they're going to get them. And you're not going to change their mind or get them to go out and buy your book because you turned it off at the library. They're just going to find somebody else to read.
Well, I have a thought about that, because the most interesting thing that when I was reading this article is they broke it down by income of readers, and readers who make over $75,000 are the ones getting it from the library, most likely to, where people who are making lower income are buying the books. So I don't know, maybe you should turn it off, JD. I'm not saying that. We love you, libraries.
No, no.
We love you.
Libraries are breeding grounds for lifelong fans. Yes. That's what happens. And they will go buy your books.
Well, and not only they might not, but if they love you as an author, they're going to talk to you and your book, and then other people are going. I think it gets a little myopic to look at just one reader's habits and one reader. People who love your writing are going to talk about you. I throw the books. I'm Christine's book sommelier. I read a book and I'm like, oh, you'd love this, and I do that with everyone I know. So,
and I buy them.
I think that it pays. Just let people read your books.
Yeah,
I've always said that. I mean, I like making money from book sales, but I have written and would write for free if that's all I was able to do, and I will for the rest of my life. So, I love making money. I got to make a living, but I don't do this for the money. I promise you, I do it because I can't stop doing it. It's really sort of an obsession. I think I might need help. So next story, Subterranean Press to close. After more than 30 years in business, Subterranean Press has announced it will continue to publish books through the end of 2027 and possibly into 2028 while it winds down operations. Subterranean became one of the most respected specialty presses in science fiction, fantasy, and horror, publishing beautiful limited editions and works by major authors such as Ted Chiang, N.K. Jemisin, John Scalzi, Joe Hill, and many others.
Well, what is with all the Debbie Downer stories? I've got a bunch of these.
So do I. I must have like 50 yeah. Subterranean books, at least. You probably have more. I'm sad.
Well, I like to get the signed ones. Like when Stephen King let me use some of his characters in Forsaken, I wanted to thank him somehow. And like, how do you, get a present for Stephen King? I had a copy of Something Wicked This Way Comes signed by Ray Bradbury that was from these guys, in a really nice slipcase and stuff. And I sent it to him as a thank you for that. But all the books that I've gotten from them, like they come in these really cool cases, most of them are signed by the authors. Like they look like a collectible item straight off the bat. And it's again, sad to see them go. I'm guessing the price point just wasn't obtainable. Like people just can't do it anymore.
Yeah.
They seem like they sell well. So I wonder, I don't know. I mean, everyone, like they sell out.
Yeah, like they were special edition books before special edition books were a thing, right? Like,
yeah,
I don't know. I'm just looking at my collection and going, maybe these are going to be worth a lot of money now. So although I'm sad, there you go.
Yeah.
Well, I know like that particular one, the Ray Bradbury, like I think it was there was 100 or something in that print run. So there weren't a lot of them. I think I paid $2,400 for it, like when I got it from them. I've got no idea what it's actually worth now because Bradbury was still alive when I bought it.
Yeah.
I like finding them at used bookstores. Like I buy them new and find, and so I've got like a Ligotti that's super rare that I found in California and a couple of other ones. And oh man, when I can find them at a discount, that makes me so happy. But I also buy the new ones. So anyway, that's I'm cool. sad that that's going because it was such a cool specialty press. But
maybe someone will come along and buy it and keep it going. You never know.
You never know. You've got a maybe couple JD of years will buy here. It.
Ooh, JD.
I have enough balls in the air. No, thank you.
Oh, come on.
You wanted a printing press. There you go.
I wanted a bookstore. And every time I look at actually opening a bookstore, everybody talks me out of it.
Yeah.
JD, I'm right there with you, man. If you look at my my yearbook from my graduating year of high school, everybody signed it, "Good luck with your bookstore." And it has been all those years since, and I still have yet to open in a bookstore. Because of that reason. Maybe later. All right. Landmark German ruling declares Google's AI overviews are Google's own words and makes it liable for false answers. A German regional court has ruled that Google is directly liable for false claims in its AI-generated search overviews. In this case, Google's AI had wrongly linked two publishers to scams and shady business practices. The court treated the AI overviews as Google's own content and rejected Google's argument that users were responsible for fact-checking the results themselves. See, this is what comes when you pivot from actual search to using AI to do all the search for you.
Yeah, especially when you know that AI is not as reliable. Like a search doesn't give you like an answer. A search gives you websites that you have to then click into and read to get the context. But the AI allegedly gives you all that context. So if it's correct. Wrong, like good, I'm glad. Yeah. Consequences.
This is a big deal though, because Google is like they're moving towards this. You know, if you go back a couple of months ago, you'd search for something, a little box would pop up in the top corner with a summary by an AI, and then you'd get all the links behind it. Then they accidentally let this slip, I guess, about a week or two ago, but their search results went completely into the AI. You know, so you search for something, you got an AI answer, and like you were stuck within that AI until you clicked out of it, and then you could get to the links. A lot of people pushed back on that, and they said, oh, it wasn't supposed to come out, it was a bug in the glitch, some kind of glitch or whatever, and I guess they're dialing that back. But that's clearly where they plan to go, with all of this. So now if this ruling actually stands and this starts to spread to other countries, they may have to nix that altogether because they're not going to take that liability.
Yep.
Good.
So maybe Google search will work once again. They'll go back
maybe
to 2023.
But the problem is it's more or less become irrelevant because people are turning to AI anyway. So they were trying to ride that current.
That's the probably the bigger story, because if Google's AI, like if they can be found liable for that, why can't Anthropic be liable for something that Claude puts up on my screen?
Well, I'll tell you why. Because Anthropic and the other AI companies aren't advertising it as use us to find correct answers. They're advertising it as you should check, double check, triple check. Google is a search engine. But and so they're saying use us to find your answers.
They have gotten in trouble. That's why, which one was it? OpenAI had to like get rid of their sycophant version because, you know, it was like encouraging people to commit suicide. Like they did get in trouble for that. So they can be held liable for, depending on how off the rails the AI gets. Like I definitely think that even if they say like, oh, you can't believe it, like there are going to be some consequences for AI.
Yeah, but this is just that. This is a very specific corridor, though. The whole search concept, because Google kind of crossed the line from being a search engine to being the answer. And if they're going to do that, then they're liable for what they're telling people.
That's no different than ChatGPT giving me an answer or Claude giving me an answer. Like it's presenting that answer. And if it's got a hallucination in it, which is essentially what just got Google in trouble, I could see them getting, you know, like if the wrong hallucination pops up and somebody files a lawsuit, I could see that, you know, the same ruling.
Yeah, I think that this is going to, it's going to carry over. It's definitely going to carry
over.
You
could throw a disclaimer out there. It's not going to make any difference.
It won't.
Right, but it goes to what is the tool intended for? And Google was intended for that. Nobody intended ChatGPT to do that.
But they are advertising AI as a way to learn. And so it is intending on being, here's the answer. They can put a little asterisk and be like, oh, use at your own discretion. But I don't know. I think that this decision will start to branch out to all AI.
Yeah.
To give you an example where this could go wrong, there's let me see if I still have it on my phone. There's an AI program called Open Evidence that's being adopted by the medical community. So you actually need a medical license to actually get in there. It physically looks like Claude, so I'm guessing that they're using Anthropic as the backbone for it. But it's diagnosing patients. It's providing medical advice to the physician that's actually holding it in his hand or her hand. If it gives the wrong diagnosis and somebody dies, somebody gets hurt, somebody, you know, whatever, I can see that blowing up and turning into, you know, something that challenges the same thing.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's true. The interesting part is when you have a closed system of AI that I'm hoping that is, and it's for like a specific thing and it's only getting medical research, you hope that it is a bit better. But also, I would not want my doctor using it. Although they do, because I went in to talk to my nutritionist. She's like, let me ask ChatGPT. And I was like, oh God, I could do this at home. Bye.
Each of these services has a terms of service that you agree to when you start using it. And part of it is waiving off that liability. Google doesn't have that. So when you jump in and do a Google search, it's raw internet. Everybody's expecting that to be an honest, you know, true result instead of something an AI made up. And it has been for, you know, all these couple of decades now, right?
Yeah.
But now that's changed as they've turned to AI.
That is true. But I do think that people are pushing back, and I think courts are pushing back on, like, you can't just like put the entire, you know, every clause and disclaimer in a terms of service and be like, well, you agreed to this, so sorry it killed you. There are limits to what is acceptable to be put in those terms and limits.
That's true.
I think we're going to start to find what those limits are.
Do you remember the story of the guy whose wife died from a food allergy at Disney Springs, and they tried to tell him they weren't liable because he used to use Disney Plus?
Yep. Yeah. Like.
So yeah, I can totally see.
But
pushback.
Disney lost that case, right?
Yeah, they lost that case.
Yeah.
So, right. But it shows you how far these companies are willing to push things.
Yeah, they will push it, but I think that the courts will start to push back for sure.
You bought a ticket to a Disney movie once. So, and when you did that.
Oh, all right.
We get to murder you for free.
I guess we should talk about our interview on that note. JD, who's up this week?
This week we've got Lauren Oliver on. Lauren's a screenwriter, a media entrepreneur, and an author of multiple New York Times bestsellers. Her novel Before I Fall was adapted into a feature film called Panic, and then adapted again into a series on Amazon Prime. She's back with a new thriller called The Girl in the Lake, about a girl who claims to remember a past life. This one, I believe, just released at the beginning of June. Here she is, Lauren Oliver.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
I've been a fan of yours for quite some time.
Oh.
Way back, the Delirium series and
Yep.
all of those. So,
Yep. Old as the goodies.
very excited to talk to you today.
Thank you. I'm so thrilled to be here. Thanks for having me.
So before we get into your new book, which is an adult thriller and very fun, we kind of like to start all the way at the beginning and get your writer origin story. So how did you get started writing?
I think my love of writing really came out of a deep, lifelong love of reading, as it does for so many of us. For me, the two activities, I kind of don't remember a time where they were, totally distinct. I should say my father's a writer, so he's a nonfiction writer. He writes nonfiction, true crime, historical true crime. And so writing as an activity was very like present in my household. I remember coming down every morning, my dad would be at his keyboard. So because of that, again, to me, there was just kind of this porous, story enjoyment kind of, activity that encompassed both writing and reading. So, I would read books that I loved, and I would write little stories that were shameless ripoffs of those books that I loved. I mean, today it might be called fan fiction. That's essentially what I was doing. And I think it was really great experimentation for, I was unconsciously emulating different, not well, but different writers' voices and things like that. And it just was a habit that I kept doing. I mean, it's really like a muscle. Once I started training it so young, I mean, this was back in elementary school, I just kept having ideas for stories, being inspired by books I read. And, the first time I ever attempted to write a novel was when I was a freshman in high school, actually.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I didn't finish, but and it was still a Jane. It was like I was modernizing a Jane Austen book in an American high school.
Oh,
So I
wow.
was still heavily being inspired by whatever I was reading at the time.
Well, those Jane Austen modernizations are popular. Maybe you should
Yeah.
dig it up
Dust
and
it off. Yeah. Find that 1997 draft. Yeah.
Yeah,
Yeah.
just like really get the authentic feel of what it was like to be in high school.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
How did you go about like what was the final catalyst that got you from, your fan fiction to like, okay, I'm going to try to write and get an agent, and what was that process like for you?
I mean, it was progressive. There was no particular catalyst. I think, I continued writing. I was always working on something all the way through college. And I guess I just saw, again, my parents are also both professors, so I kind of saw writing as this is something that you do. You just produce books on the side of whatever else you're doing. So, I'd moved to New York after college in Chicago and was working, got a very low level job in publishing. Again, really didn't have many interests besides reading and writing.
Writing.
And I'd simultaneously applied to a writing program. I think part of it was that I didn't really know what to do. Like, I really didn't know what I wanted to do. I thought about going to law school, as also many writers weirdly do. And again, that's when I was inspired to apply for a publishing job, and I realized that you could get a master's in creative writing, and it felt like, oh, this will give me more time to figure something out. But it was so around that kind of mushy 5-year period, I did manage to start completing books. I completed two adult novels that were, aspired to be great works of literature because, that's what you're reading when you're in grad school. Needless to say, neither one got me an agent nor published. But around that time, I also ended up working in a young adult division of Penguin Books for young readers. And that's when I really discovered the young adult category. And that really changed the landscape of stuff that I was thinking about writing. And it was actually in my first 6 months there that I had the idea to write my first novel that ended up being published, which was Before I Fall.
Wow. That's so interesting that sort of like that career took you to the introduction of young adult and then just sort of write it sort of when young adult was in its, I don't want to say infancy, but it was definitely blossoming around that time.
Blossoming. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
Yeah.
absolutely.
So interesting how life can sometimes meander its way perfectly. Yeah. As you're writing and obviously as you're kind of in grad school, like different processes, what was your process back then and has it changed at all in terms of how you tackle writing a novel?
Actually, the process itself is relatively actually remained stable for all these years. Which is typically that, once I get to the point where there's an idea that's kind of coalescing into something cohesive and there's a voice and I can start kind of hearing the lines in my head for the first page or two, I do sit down and start writing. And typically within the first 20,000 words, I am going to discover whether this idea actually is hanging together and whether I think that there's a path forward. And sometimes I don't know immediately, right? I'm struggling with a or grappling with a possible idea for a next book now. I've written about 15,000 words. I'm in the phase of trying to figure out, does it now work? Would it work beyond these 15,000 words? Would I be able to structure something interesting? Is this structure, does it make sense to structure something this way, given the themes of the book, given the early setup of the book, right? So I think the thing that's changed is that I'm able to understand and think through those questions a little bit more clearly. But from the beginning, I actually would, sit down for Before I Fall and, write some large-ish chunk to see if the voice was there and then step back and say, is this a novel? Is it something more than just a voice?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. So do you at that point then like figure out like what your beats are, or do you just like once you've decided, oh, a novel's here and this is how, and then just go for it, just sort of write.
That is it depends. I definitely try to figure out where the story is going and how rigorous I am about the beats themselves. It somewhat depends on a novel, on the novel, but in general, yes, I like to actually figure out the mechanics of the book at that point because again, it somewhat depends on the category of book and where I ultimately think it will be, but if it's a mystery thriller, I need to make sure there's an actual mystery that is going to get solved and has a reasonable explanation. And if it's a, more speculative novel or doesn't f immediately, I can't identify what the genre is. I have to, because I make my living doing this, I have to make sure that there's actually a commercial story there. And I'm not just writing random character notes, which is something that I absolutely have the capacity to do. So I usually go, I try to figure out, the mechanics. And that part can take a really long time.
Yeah, figuring out all the, yeah, I would imagine, particularly when you're sort of genre hopping a little bit.
A little bit. Well, I definitely have in the past.
Yeah. So how do you balance sort of, or how do you tackle the changes in the genre? Because that's not something that's always like easy or intuitive to figure out.
No, and part of it is, the nice thing was when I was younger and writing YA, YA got to be the overall umbrella that I was publishing into. So I could do a lot of, I could do a lot of different subcategories because YA as a whole was still kind of young enough or small enough where they all got bucketed into YA, and that was my brand. Moving into adult, it's still something I'm trying to figure out because, you know, I really do. I personally love mystery, thriller, suspense, everywhere from, you know, very commercial versions of that to extremely elevated ones, like Tana French. And I also even love down to like cozy mysteries, which, you know, were my comfort reading growing up. So, you know, and it is one of those things that I actually had to reconcile, you know, just in a kind of adult way and learn to accept is that actually, you know, again, if you want to have a commercial publishing career, then you do have to be mindful of telling an overall narrative inside of your own work, right? Readers have to know what they can go to you for and what they can't go to you for. So and now at the same time, like, you know, the work has to live for me too. I have to be excited by what I'm doing. I have to be feel a little bit challenged, you know? So I would say I don't have a perfect answer to that. I'm still looking at finding a balance of really honing in on what I think makes a Lauren Oliver book, right? Mm-hmm. Especially in this new era where I'm going into adult and adult suspense. And I do hope and trust that there can be a little wiggle room inside of that. But yeah, early in my career, I would just write whatever I wanted to write. I would stick a random pen name on it, you know? And it was like, there are books I've written that people would be shocked to learn were written by me. Like shocked.
Oh, really?
I mean, not like sexy time books, but like literally like a crazy sci-fi, weird futuristic novel that like people online thought was written by George R. R. Martin under a pen name.
Oh, you know? Interesting.
Yeah.
Ooh, nice.
Well, I'm not going to do any of that. It was
nice little mystery out there for.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
For people.
Yeah.
So what made you sort of want to, was it just because you had been able to have that freedom as a YA writer that you kind of wanted to continue to, like you said, challenge yourself and dabble in other genres? Or, you know, kind of what prompted the idea of, because I know you've written middle grade before and now you're doing that adult thriller suspense mystery. So what prompted that?
I mean, I think I was, I mean, in terms of the transition to adult, just writ large, I think I was ready to talk about different things. I think honestly, I was ready to explore, you know, certain things I was going through as an adult, including divorce. I struggled with addiction for about 5 years. I've been sober now for 4. You know, things that I felt belonged in adult novels. On the other hand, it wasn't super conscious. It was again, a kind of gradual a gradient. I wrote a book called What Happened to Lucy Vale, which everybody hates, but that book was really shows the, like myself in transition, because there was a lot of it took place in a high school with a wee version, but then there was an adult mother character that was a point of view character and you can kind of feel in the novel, which is, I think, one of the reasons it didn't work, this dual self, this self kind of in a period of transition, this writer in a period of transition, who wasn't totally sure where to go. So, and then in terms of suspense and thriller, you know, I mean, the idea for The Girl in the Lake, which is the first in a series that hopefully I'll get to continue, is, I mean, it really did fall into my head based on a lot of my current interests, a lot of things that have interested me, in fact, for years. But at the same time, the idea of writing in that kind of suspense thriller space, I mean, I do think that sometimes when people are struggling with what they want to write next or where they want their career to go is to return to, like, what are you actually reading? Like, what is on your shelf? What do you love and what do you pick up night after night? And for me, that was the answer, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I do think people kind of sometimes forget that, particularly if you're kind of, you know, over a long period. I mean, in Hollywood, they call it like being typecast. And I do think there's a risk of that in publishing a little bit, that like, well, no, you're known for this, but as you evolve.
Yeah.
So I loved The Girl in the Lake. That it was
Thank you.
such a fun read.
Thank you.
The idea of, reincarnation and past lives, and then like the scientific aspects of it. Where did this idea come from?
So I have been obsessed with the University of Virginia's Division of Perceptual Studies for years. I don't know how I first heard about it. I truly don't remember how I first heard about it. I'm kind of interested in general. I wouldn't say necessarily in the paranormal, right? I mean, ghosts are very cool, but I mean more in kind of again in consciousness and how little we know about it, in how little it's been rigorously studied, because basically in the West we have what's called a materialist perspective. We have the point of view that anything that is not, basically that all of the everything that exists is made up of matter, right? And that is in a position, it's a hypothesis, but it hasn't actually been proven. And in fact, in many attempts to prove it have failed, but we still hold that as almost doctrine, right? Even though other cultures don't. So my sister also, I should say, is a researcher who does some, who studies a lot of things that are adjacent. She's a philosopher, but she studies the philosophy of cognitive science. So she looks at the brain, at brain studies to answer questions, philosophical questions about consciousness. So this is kind of like another thing that is mushy and free floating in my family. So I found out about the University of Virginia, and I'd just done a ton of research about their research, which includes works into, one of the largest studies ever on children who report past life memories. It includes near-death experience studies on people who report on near-death experiences, or I think now they're called recalled experiences of death, and various other things. And I don't know. I mean, it just was. Maybe I was reading another mystery thriller at that point, or thinking about mystery thrillers, and I just thought, how wild would it be if I could bring together like a researcher and a child, and the child has memories that the researcher can identify. Like she knows what those memories were. And I, you know, it, some ideas, just are, you're compelled by them or whatever, but some ideas just kind of hit you and you're like, that is a great idea for a book. And this was one of them.
Yeah, it's definitely a good idea. I actually really enjoyed how sort of academic Kate was. Very while she's sort of surrounding herself with like these, I don't want to say non-academic, but they're a little bit more in the belief that these things that they don't understand exist, and she's very much in the real world. I'm curious how much research you ended up doing, if any, and how you managed to, well, balance the facts with the fiction, as it were.
I did do quite a bit of research about the studies. I mean, it wasn't a super burdensome lift, but because, they're easily and readily available. But of course, I did want to know how typically a couple things. I wanted to know how past life memories usually present in children, what they would be are typically capable of remembering or not remembering. And I also wanted to know more about how those memories would be, again, vetted or validated by a DOPS, Division of Perceptual Studies researcher. And then I took liberties from there, not a ton, but of course I did, because it's a novel. But yeah, so it wasn't, I mean, it's, again, you can find their studies online that they've published about the impact or the results of these, this big study about children who recall past life. And look, it's really compelling. I mean,
And a little
you
bit
know, here's the
creepy.
thing, because you can always find ways to doubt or ways to this, but it's compelling research. It just is.
And a little bit creepy.
100% creepy. But I love creepy children. In fact, I'm thinking of making creepy children my new brand.
I am 100% for this, actually.
Okay.
I think that's a fantastic idea.
Warren Oliver for creepy children. Yeah.
Yes, someone has to do it. I
Yeah,
mean, it
someone has to do it. It might as well be me.
right, might as well be you. And you're gonna have a nice firm head start with the series. Like, you'll have
Exactly.
well on
No,
your way.
exactly. In book two, there's another creepy child who's slightly older
Right.
still. Yeah.
What surprised you the most while you were writing this book?
Oh, I will answer that by saying what surprised me the most about writing this book was that I could still write. So I went through a and that I could still have a lot of fun writing. I went through a really, really difficult time, basically from COVID, from just before COVID hit through COVID to when that's when I went to get sober. And I really had struggled with writing during that time. I kind of lost the ability to feel confidence in my own writing and to kind of hear writing on the page and to just, I really, really truly believe, like if you'd asked me on May 12th, 2 years ago, I might have told you that I didn't think I would ever publish again. I might have told you that I didn't think I would ever write again. So that was the big, maybe it was maybe like maybe 2023. Maybe by then I was already writing Girl in the Lake. But so I think that was actually the biggest surprise for me, was just that I could find my way into a book again and actually have some fun doing it, right? And now not every book is, I mean, and certainly not every day, even if you're writing a fun book, it's not always fun. In fact, I would say it's probably rarely fun
Yes.
to actually go through the process. But I mean this on a deep kind of deeper level than that, right? Because I
Yeah.
did. I thought I knew this book was fun from the beginning,
Yeah.
and it is. It's just an enjoyable read,
It really is.
Yeah,
Yeah.
thanks.
And I think that's, I mean, I do think that everyone goes through that, particularly writers that are sort of early in the process. Like, querying is brutal. So, I know a lot of writers who have gotten very disheartened, not just from the publishing as an industry, but just personal reasons happen, and it can be really hard. So,
Absolutely. Yeah,
yeah, I'm
absolutely.
glad you found your way
Thank you.
back.
Thank you. Yeah,
You're
so am I.
very welcome.
Yeah, so am I.
Yeah. So we always like to wrap up with the same question, which is, what's one piece of advice you would give to new or aspiring writers?
Well, I mean, it relates to what you just said. It's interesting because, when you're new or aspiring, all you want to do is get that first book. You just want to get that first yes. And that is an important milestone, but there will be endless milestones after that, right? And it's so easy to feel discouraged. And I think, as much as possible to connect to and enjoy the actual act of creating itself, right? And not tether yourself to outcomes. I think creativity and human creativity is so centrally important. I think the creative act itself is like important on a spiritual level. And I'm saying this advice when a lot of times I don't know how to follow it or I get away from it. But I think that is the most important thing because if you can do that, you'll be able to weather the waits and the reversals and the times your career stalls and the times it goes backwards and the heights, and it will all be part of a journey. And the real thing, which is getting, more creative, more, better, richer, in how you create, that will be in place. That will stay in place.
Oh, I love that. Well, thank you so much for talking with me today. I had
Thank
such a
you.
nice time. And
Thank you. So did I.
I think that yeah, anyone who likes creepy kids should get Girl
Yeah.
on Lake,
Creepy kids,
definitely.
go to Lauren Oliver.
I am so happy that she is back. I loved her books when they were first coming out. And then she kind of, got quiet, obviously was dealing with a lot. But yeah, I'm glad she came back. I thought it was really interesting how she said She was surprised she could still write, like that was the biggest thing. Having a crisis in the career. Have you ever experienced that? And how did you get over it? Because I think that that's something that's common and probably not talked about too much.
Well, I guess, yeah, early on I had some personal stuff I was dealing with. I had started writing and then had a family crisis and didn't write for, I think, at least a year. I don't know, like, you just sometimes life happens and you can't write when that's going on. But I think those of us that are writers, as Kevin said, like, you have an obsession, you'll find your way back to it when you're able.
Yeah, it's
So,
kind of the opposite
yeah.
for me. Like, I use writing as the thing that distracts me from all those other things. So if something crazy happens in my life, I'll go and work on a short story or work on a book or something because it takes my mind off of whatever that other problem is.
Do you ever put those problems in your short stories and books? Like, do you ever like write to sort of like work through it?
No, I think I write to escape and get away from it. Like the only time something's ever worked its way into my writing is when my wife was pregnant. She stopped drinking coffee, so I stopped drinking coffee in solidarity. And then when I turned in that particular book to my editor, he called me like a week later. He's like, "Do you have some kind of problem with coffee?" Because like I had mentioned coffee like so many times, had so many characters drinking it, and like that was all subconscious. Like I had no idea that I was going overboard with that. But like that's the only time that like real life has really crept into one of my books for me.
That's pretty funny. What is your deal with coffee?
Yeah, I love coffee.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She had said that she writes until she knows that there's an idea, and it takes her about 15,000 words. When do you know an idea has like legs, when it'll be like what you want it to be, and how do you find that? Do you just go for it, or?
I don't know about you guys, but like I've always known, like the idea, like I'll have a couple different things will come together and it just clicks. I'm like, okay, that's it. And then I'm off to the races. And like until I feel that, like I don't actually really start on the project.
Yeah, I think it's in the pre-work, right? And like, oh, I had this idea, and then I'll usually like pitch it to a couple people, and they're like, "That's great." Then I'm like, "Okay, that's it." And then they're like, "Okay," I'm like, "Okay, maybe not. Maybe that needs some more work." But yeah, I think it's before you start writing, if it's not something I'm wholly committed to and feel is in some way going to be commercial that other people are interested in, I don't think I'm going to put a year of my life into
All
that.
my stuff starts as a title, every book, every short story, and I don't know what it's going to be about until it's written, really. And I always trust that it's going to be good. So I
Interesting.
don't know what that says about me,
Although
but
it can take me like 15,000 words or more to find the voice of the character. Like, you know what I
yeah,
mean?
that's a little different though. It
Yeah.
sounds like she doesn't necessarily know what the story is about. I mean,
Yeah.
what it got me thinking, like I've got an app on my phone where I just write down every idea that I get. And I've got a ton of like really, really solid openers for a book, but I don't know where the book is going to go after that opener. So those things will sit there for years sometimes. And then, some other idea will come to me that some may have nothing to do with the original idea, but like I'll take, idea A, pair it with idea B, and all of a sudden when I put the two together, it makes perfect sense, and then I've got a novel. But I won't actually sit there and start writing it. I know plenty of people that do though. They'll, just
Yeah.
roll up in a white blank, Word document and just start going just to see where it leads them.
Have you ever taken a short story and been like, oh, there's like way more potential, and then expanded it out? Because I think that's kind of a common thing that I.
Yeah, I've done that. And done the reverse. I've done both, but I've got several
What do you mean the reverse?
taken something I thought was going to be a novel and then cut it back to be a short story
Oh.
because I realized, the concept is great, but the action around the idea kind of peters out somewhere toward the middle, and I realized this was better as a short story, and so I trim it down. But yeah, I've done that several times though in the other direction with short stories that became novels. I think I'm working on one right now, actually. I'm worried that I am because I specifically want it to be a short story.
It's not going to listen to you. Well,
It's like, no, I'm free. I will run.
yeah. I think though that I'm going to have a lot more book ideas after I get accepted into the Department of Perceptual Studies for my next degree.
Dude.
I mean, but who among us won't really?
You can apply with me, Jenna? Let's go apply. Let's go do another
Yes.
degree.
That was one of when I was reading the book, and like, she's talking about like all these different things. And I've kind of heard about that before, like the reincarnation, but
Yeah.
The fact that there's actual like a university that like studies this and like tries to prove it scientifically,
Yeah.
I'm obsessed.
That's so cool. I pulled their website up. I haven't dug into the actual courses and stuff, but I'm going to. I'm so
Yeah.
interested
I
about what they
know.
do.
We can become obsessed together.
I don't know if I ever told you guys this story, but right before my dad died, like him and I had never really had any real conversations together. But right before he died, we sat down and he started telling me about where he grew up in Austria. And he was telling me about his family. Like part of the problem, like his family got stuck on the wrong side of the Berlin Wall. And by the time that came down, like half of them were dead or they were old and they were gone. And so he completely blocked that portion of his life out. So he just didn't want to talk about it. But he started describing the house where he grew up. And I grabbed a sheet of paper and I started to draw it. And like I knew where all the rooms were before he actually told me. So like I was able to sketch out like the entire house where my dad grew up, like and start pointing out like furniture and weird things like that that I shouldn't know. So that put me down this rabbit hole where I started investigating this. And there's a theory that memories can be passed down through DNA, which is why
Yeah.
some people can speak languages that they shouldn't speak, or somebody gets in an accident and all of a sudden they can play piano. There's this theory says that all of these memories are just passed down. Like we have all of them in within us, but they're locked.
Yeah. They've talked about that with trauma. Like I think they started realizing that that happens like with the Holocaust. They kind of started realizing that like kids of Holocaust survivors and grandkids of Holocaust survivors were like holding on to these like ghost memories that they shouldn't have.
Yeah, it's crazy. I think a lot of like the stuff tied to reincarnation, I think it's all part of that same mix. We just don't understand what it is yet.
We are
Well,
all star stuff.
yeah, it is the I guess the curse of living a linear existence with a monkey brain in a universe that is not linear or designed for our
Yeah.
brains to understand in any kind of way. I minored in physics and it scared the shit out of me. And I know now that I know nothing. So
Yeah.
thank you
Right.
for that,
That's
higher
when you study
education.
physics, it doesn't take long to realize I don't know anything.
It's like, yeah, I'm like, I don't know anything. And I can't, because of the way of my biology, know anything ever. So
Yeah.
thanks for that existential crisis. I appreciate that.
There's a whole conversation with some guy from MIT who did a podcast interview, and he was talking about how we are surrounded by aliens, but we cannot see them because we're biologically incapable of seeing them,
Yeah.
and that it's we're physical beings in an energy world or something along those lines. And I'm like, that makes absolute sense to me.
It's entirely
Having,
possible, right? We don't know and we can't know, and that's kind of the
well,
point. So
and
there
there's
you
all
go.
those phenomenons like deja vu and like just all
You can
these
say that
things
again.
that that happen that we can't explain, that when you start looking in physics and quantum physics and they have these answers and you're like, well, that makes sense, but also it's terrifying.
Well, it was like when I was listening to this interview and she said, oh, we all say everything is made up of matter. Well, I'm like, but what is matter? We said it was made up of atoms and then they were divisible and that's divisible. Nothing behaves the way that we think. And I went down a whole matter spiral, but that's fine. I'm like, we don't even know what matter is. We say everything's made up. We have no idea what matter is. Anyway, I hope you've enjoyed your existential crisis this week on Writers Inc. JD, who's up next week?
Next, we've got Sarah Vaughan on. Sarah is a Sunday Times and international best-selling author of several novels. She also spent 15 years working as a journalist, including 11 years at The Guardian as a political correspondent and news reporter. Her latest novel is called Based on a True Story. It's about an author who will do anything to protect the secret she's been keeping for more than 50 years. So that should be interesting. Sarah Vaughan.
Yeah, it's going to be great. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.